you've created that imaginary future and there are no humans. Are there rules about which animals you've reintroduced or not? And then to be consistent about it, did you have to think that through in terms of how everything worked, what communication worked, all of those things?
Yeah, I mean, I love rules. So it's definitely rules. I love rules. And really, it's interesting that I'm writing, I guess it's speculative fiction, or you might call it sci-fi, or, you know, I'm very much about grounded reality. So it's okay, I've got my one speculative bit, well, my two, it's the future and that the wildlands exist. But from then on, it was like, how do I make this as real as possible? So it was a lot of rules. It was thinking, okay, I don't want them to get rescued by an adult. So I don't want any people in the wildlands, but then just not sort of arbitrarily deciding that. So, okay, why aren't people allowed in the wildlands? In some ways, it holds me back as a writer that I'm so realistic and logical. I can never be like, oh, that'll be good. I'll put that in. I'm like, okay, well, I have to think through the full history of how this came about and what are the full implications and does everyone believe it and who feels what about it? Some of those sorts of rules. So that's how I came up with like the buffer zone and the size of the project and where the train line would be, all based on what would make sense. And then for the animals, I think my biggest stipulation to myself was I wanted it again to be realistic. So there are in a lot of kids' books, and I know why, because we all want this to be the case. You have kids making friends with wild animals. And it bothers me because I think it sets up an expectation that you then spend the rest of your life disappointed that you're not tramping about the countryside with a pet hare and a raven sat on your shoulder and animals chatting to you. And maybe someone is, but good for them, but it's not me. So I wanted to base it on what's it actually like to be in a wild place. And you can have incredible up-close encounters with animals, but they're not in a human way. They're in an animal way. So that was a really big rule. I didn't want the sort of fantasy animals. And then deciding which was based on research. I did a degree in zoology and I've known about rewilding since then. And then sort of George Monbiot's Feral came out and sort of reignited the whole thing for me. So it really was, let's get a list up. What are the possible animals that we're looking at reintroducing? And making decisions again about, yeah, I'm going to have elk. Or I think there's enough space for bear. I did a lot of reading about a lot of things. Don't quiz me on it. I don't know if it's all still in there. But every decision had to be a sort of stop, think about it, research it, check it moment.
I was just thinking then about the hierarchy of animals, because you couldn't really have something that would eat everything.
I'm on a rabbit hole thinking about the hierarchy of animals. I don't know how they're going to feel about it. And this is great because it actually gets to the core of rewilding. Rewilding is about reestablishing a healthy functional ecosystem. And a healthy functional ecosystem has all of the keystone species and all of the species and all of the different roles and niches. And therefore it finds balance. And a lot of the problem we have with nature in this country and all over the world is that it's out of balance and that we're trying to somehow be the ones that step in and control and create that balance. Once you see it a different way, you start to see the madness of it, really, of, oh, we've got too much of this type of small predator that's eating this bird that we're trying to protect so that we can shoot it. And the lengths that humans have to go to try to make things the way they want them, when actually things are out of balance because we're missing large predators. So then our small predators are eating too many animals, in our opinions. And that's why I wanted the wildlands to be, let's see what this country could look like when it's doing it its own way, the way that this ecosystem originally evolved to be, and how close back can we get to that? So I think once you get them all in and they've got enough space, then they'll find that balance themselves.
And there'll be a bit of eating each other, but it's fine.
That is sort of part of nature, isn't it? You know, you're going to have to accept a bit of eating. It's going to be okay.
And we had about the characters, you said you got Astrid first as the older sister. And the main characters are sisters. Does that draw on your family at all?
I have an older sister. So that sibling dynamic, when my sister read it, she was like, oh, I get it. You've just written us. I don't think it's like quite so exactly. In a way, maybe it reads even stronger to her because she's the older sibling. So me writing it from the older one point of view means it doesn't read quite as us. But I fall very naturally into that sibling dynamic, even with friends or with my own wife. I don't even know how to explain it. Just the sibling dynamic. I think if you have it, you know what I mean.
An only child. I'm a big sister, so I could see that, just how annoying little sisters can be.
I would disagree.
Yeah.
As the younger sibling.
As would my sister.
Yeah, exactly. I think how annoying the older ones can be and not realise how great.
We are super bossy.
I very much grew up, my sister would be like, we're putting on a play. Come over here and stand here. You're the curtain. actually, you're, I'm bored of you. Please leave. No, wait, come back. You can sell tickets. You know, I mean, I love her. We're very close. I think she wouldn't disagree with that, though. So as a younger sibling, you spend the whole time being like, can I hang out with you? Oh, okay. No, sorry. Oh, actually, now I can, you know.
Oh, my, it's quite good for life, actually, I think. Youngest, you know.
Yeah,
kind of work out, you know, who knows?
I think a sibling dynamic can, for better and for worse, it sets up a model for how you then build friendships, working relationships, partnerships. You know, you kind of practiced it all.
Yeah, you practice the good and the bad bits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I never did that. I've got two daughters, and I think the second one decided quite early on she wasn't going to be bossed around and has countered that narrative in terms of bossy older sister, although the older sister does assert herself in other ways.
But good for her. Yeah, maybe I should have stood up sooner.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be in the play, though. So
I've got one of each, and the younger one like wanted to go to the pub with the big sister. But now, of course, they don't want to be in the pub together at all. Now they both can.
But there's no pubs in the book. But yeah.
There's no pubs in the book. There probably was in the bit that you shut down.
Anyway. Oh, yeah, we lost some pubs. There is a pub in the book. I take it back. Yeah.
Oh, in the town.
It's a hotel with a bar rather than a pub directly.
That's quite niche because people need to read the book to get to that bit. Tell us about Indy.
So my first character was Astrid, and actually people were surprised by this, but a lot of earlier drafts of the book were only Astrid, so the two didn't come together. I was following the classic model of survival stories, which is you have one person alone and surviving. I knew that there was a second character needed, and I was trying to explore ways, like Wilson in Castaway, that you have someone to bounce off who's not a whole nother person. And I resisted adding a second child character for a long time, and then I can hear my wife in my mind yelling at me, tell them it was my idea. It was a joint co-collaboration on a walk once, I think. But as soon as I realized, like, wait, Indy's the younger sister, it just made total sense. I think really for the internal themes of the book, that Indy represents everything that Astrid was and that Astrid fears she's lost. You know, so she's very thematic in that way, but also she's just an absolute joy. And the version where I was, okay, I think Indy's going to work. I'm going to rewrite it with Indy in. And I'll just do the first three chapters. It'll either just be easy or it won't work. And as soon as I started writing Indian, it was like, there you are. You've clearly been here the whole time and I just somehow didn't notice you. So many points. Why does Astrid make that choice then? Or what changes that? Or what gives that idea? And it was Indy. Indy was always there. So yeah, as soon as she came about, she just bloomed. And I just had so much fun writing her and writing their dynamic.
I mean, I like the fact that the adults are kind of in the background, but they're not really part of the story at all, which I really liked, actually, because that's back to those, not old-fashioned, that's not the right word, but books where it's all about the kids and the kids surviving and the adults operate on the edges.
A lot of kids' books it's the trope is orphans, but the reason you do it is once you get the parents out of the way, things can get interesting. So this was a way of having the parents out of the way without orphaning my children. They're alone. They can't ask for help. They can't look anything up. Astrid's particularly at that really interesting age where she's not a kid anymore. She's the beginnings of a teenager. She's definitely not an adult, but she knows a lot about the world and herself, and she's super smart. And then there's a whole bunch of things she doesn't know or she's just not ready for. And it's just a really interesting age to explore. And it's a really interesting age to explore when you have just the kids making their own choices, finding their own way to do things. But then for me, their relationship, even though they're off stage, the relationship with their parents is kind of a crucial part of the storyline. And I wanted to keep that in there and explore that. But actually having them not there gives Astrid the space to have to work through how she's feeling about all of that.
Was there one of them that was easier to write? Or did you have a favourite?
Out of Astrid and Indy?
Yeah.
I think it was interesting because I wrote them so separately, which is unusual. You know, normally you'd have both characters and put them in. So I got to be with just Astrid on her own for a lot of drafts and really get to know her and her voice and what she was struggling with. And I'm really glad that I had that time without Indy as a distraction. But then I got to put Indy in and almost have just Indy, even though I was putting her in with Astrid. So I got to really dedicate, it's probably what every parent wants, I got to actually dedicate time to each child on their own and give them what they needed. I loved writing them both. I love both those voices. I enjoyed Astrid's sarcasm. And then the moments where she drops into like really trying to figure something out and logic brain, that's very me. I think there's a line in there that says her brain started working out on its own without her permission. It does that a lot. Mine does that a lot. Like, don't give me a problem because it'll just be whirring away. I really enjoyed that. But then I just loved writing the sheer naive in a good way, the naive joy and like awe of Indy. And it's kind of me too. I think I just split myself in half and into each of them, but I got to be with each of those. And then writing the dynamic was the best bit because you get to bounce it off. How can Indy be more Indy in this moment? How can Astrid be more Astrid? And how can that cause tension or sort of joy and love between them?
And I thought there's a really nice bit a bit later on where Astrid has to make a decision and she ums and ahs about it. And then she thinks, well, what would Indy do?
Yeah.
And she does the Indy thing, not the Astrid thing.
And I think that was really important. I wanted both characters to have a full arc in the book. You know, so Astrid's arc is obviously we're with her, so it's more obvious. But Indy grows a lot in that time. She really is just a kid in the beginning. And she's still just a kid at the end, but she has these really kind of wise moments. And a lot of the time through the story, even though Astrid's the one that's having to figure it out, having to make the decisions, she's finding that quite hard and annoying. Why does it always have to be me knowing what to do? But she's using her logic brain and being rational and figuring things out and sort of staying motivated. But at the moments when Astrid can't go on, Indy steps up then and she's like, we can do this. We just need to keep going. So I really loved interweaving that. And I really wanted that moment towards the end when Astrid, she's really come from kind of finding Indy an annoyance or just seeing her as something she's responsible for but isn't participating to actually listening to Indy. It's a coming of age story in a way. And she's not changing. It's not that her logic was wrong. She's just expanding. There's logical decisions and sometimes there's feeling decisions or sometimes it's just about doing what's right, even though it's harder. It doesn't maybe make sense. So I really wanted them both to have that journey and for the journey that they're on to kind of give them time to each develop in their own way.
We discussed their really strong environmental themes in the book. There's also quite a strong theme about the impact of technology on our future lives. What kind of discussions were you hoping to prompt from focusing on those two variables in terms of the future, what the future might hold?
So I think in the broader sense of what my future that I've written, you've got the nature side of things. So you've got this huge rewilding project, but also it stretches way beyond that. It's almost like the wildlands is the core that everything spreads out from. So you've also got a much stronger integration of humans and nature in everywhere, even in the cities, you know, so we talk about there's beavers in Stratfords and there's dolphins swimming up the River Thames. So us as people learning to live much more in harmony with nature, because that's what I'd like to see. So it's the future that I wrote. And then the technology side, sort of more broadly, I have a background in clean tech, which is environmental technologies. So anything that is more energy efficient or uses different fuel sources or makes materials in a different way or processes waste in a different way. So I've been in that world for a long time now. And to me, it's very natural that that would integrate into the future as well. It's a struggle because for most of the problems that we face, from a technology point of view, we already have the solutions. You know, it's an implementation issue that we face, not a we don't know how to do it. So that was almost very easy. And actually, I think that there's more that's in my head than that's in the book because they're in the wildlands for the whole time. You know, you don't actually see much of that future world outside of it, but that renewable energy is the norm and their phones solar charged, and also that phones, you take it to a repair shop to get it upgraded. You don't just get a whole new phone. And I don't think I get into this one, but there's not really single car ownership and all those sorts of things. I think that is what our future could very easily look like. And I would hope that it does. And then there's the whole technology side of her connection with her phone, which is something I really wanted to explore. It's another one, children's writers talk about this a lot. The first thing you need to do is get rid of the parents. And then I think it's Jacqueline Wilson talks about this. And then the next thing you need to do is get rid of the phone. Because even though so much of our lives are lived through our phones, it's really difficult and not that interesting. Some people, I'm sure, have pulled it off brilliantly, but it's hard to write. So you'll see in a lot of AA and middle grade books that the phones run out of battery or it needs to go. And also because without your phone, it forces you to be fully present. And I wanted them to have that experience of being in wilderness, being in nature. There's lots of studies that show, I think it's after like 3 full days and nights in nature, something in your brain actually starts to change. So obviously they'd just get rescued if they could just text someone. So that had to go. But there is a storyline around that. And it's not meant in a kind of preachy or blamey way of that, like, oh, it's terrible that we're all on our phones and we have to get off them. I think we do have a real problem that needs rebalancing, maybe. And that is both, though, because in a way the phone is so crucial to them throughout the entire story. And it doesn't function as a phone for that time. So it's like it's very there whilst being not there at the same time. And I think one of the things I questioned when I was like, okay, I'm writing 25 years in the future, you know, maybe we have microchips in our brains. I think for the story, I didn't want that side of technology to have developed that much. And also maybe it won't. You know, we've been through a huge technological leap. It doesn't mean that that's where our big advances are going to keep going in the next couple of decades. So I imagine that the phone that she's on does look different to phones we have now and have different functionalities.